Repetition is dullness, murmured Hare, and dullness, as somebody has remarked, is the one unforgivable sin. Right, agreed Trevor. It is, and plenty of murderers have suffered for it. Well, hey there, good folks and friends. How the heck are you? Keith Tyler bringing you the Mystery Hour here on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I am so grateful that you've tuned in to join us today. I'm going to get into our first story. It's from the Best American Mystery Stories of the Century. This one was written back in 1928, so nearly 100 years ago. Ben Ray Redman wrote it, and it's called The Perfect Crime. The world's greatest detective complacently sipped some port, some years older than himself, and intently gazed across the table at his most intimate acquaintance. For many years, the detective had not permitted himself the luxury of friends. Gregory Hare looked back at him, waiting, listening. "There's no doubt about it," Trevor reiterated, putting down his glass. "The perfect crime is a possibility. It requires only the perfect criminal." "Well, naturally," assented Hare with a shrug, "but the perfect criminal, you mean he is a mythical fellow, not apt to be met with in the flesh?" "Exactly," said Hare, nodding his big head. Trevor sighed, sipped again, and adjusted his eyeglasses on his thin, sharp nose. "No, I admit, I haven't encountered him as yet, but I am always hopeful." "Hopeful to be done in the eye, eh?" "No, hoping to see the perfect methods of detection tested to the limits of their possibilities. You know, a gifted detector of crime is something more than an inspired policeman with a little bloodhound blood in his veins. Something more than a precise scientist. He is an art critic as well, and no art critic likes to be condemned to a steady diet of second-rate stuff." "Quite. Second-rate stuff is bad enough, but it's not the worst. Think of the third, fourth, fifth, and heaven knows what rate crimes that come along every day. And even the masterpieces, the classics, are pretty poor daubs when you look at them closely. A bad tone here, and a wrong line there. Something false, something botched." "Most murderers are rather, well, foolish," interjected Hare. "Foolish? Oh, well, of course they are. You should know, man, you've defended enough of them." "The trouble is that murder almost never evokes the best efforts of the best minds. As a rule, it is the work of an inferior mind, cunning, striving toward a perfection that is beyond its reach, or of a superior mind so blinded by passion that its facilities are temporarily impaired. Of course, there are your homicidal maniacs, and they are often clever, but they lack imagination and variety. Sooner or later, their inability to do anything but repeat themselves brings them up with a sharp jerk." "Repetition is dullness," murmured Hare, "and dullness, as somebody has remarked, is the one unforgivable sin." "Right," agreed Trevor. "It is, and plenty of murderers have suffered for it. But they have suffered from vanity almost as much. Practically every murderer, unless he has been accidentally impelled to crime, is an egregious egotist. You know that as well as I do. His sense of power is tremendous, and as a rule, he can't keep his mouth shut." Dr. Harrison Trevor's glasses shone brightly, and he plucked continually at the black cord depending from them as he jerked out his sentences with rapidity and precision. He was on his own ground, and he knew what he was talking about. For 20 years, criminals had been his specialty and his legitimate prey. He had hunted them through all lands, and he hunted them successfully. Upstairs, in a chiffonier drawer in his bedroom, there was a large red leather box holding visible symbols of that success. Small decorations of gold and silver and bright ribbons bore mute witness to the gratitude that various European governments had felt, on notable occasion, toward the greatest man hunter of his generation. If Trevor was a dogmatist on murder, he was entitled to be one. Hare, on the other hand, was a good and respectful listener, but being a criminal lawyer of long experience, he was a man with ideas of his own, and he always expressed them when there was no legal advantage to be gained by withholding them. He expressed one now when he drawled softly, "All murderers are great egotists, they are. How about great detectives?" Trevor blinked, then smiled coldly, clutching at his black cord. "Most detectives are asses. I grant you, complete asses, as vain as peacocks. Very few of them are great. I know of only three. One of them is now in Vienna, the second is in Paris, and the third is..." Hare raised his hand in interruption and said, "The third, or rather the first, is in this room." The greatest detective in all the world nodded briskly. "Of course, there's no point in false modesty here, is there?" "None at all, and it might be a little difficult to maintain such an attitude so soon after the Harrington case. Oh, the poor chap was put out of his misery last week, wasn't he?" Trevor snorted. "Yes, if you want to call him a poor chap. He was a deliberate murderer. But let's get back to that perfect crime of ours." "Well, of yours, you mean," Hare corrected him politely. "I haven't subscribed to the possibility of it as yet. And how would you know about a perfect crime if it ever were committed? The criminal would never be discovered." "If he had an artistic pride, he would leave a full account of it to be published after his death. Well, besides, you are forgetting the perfect methods of detection." Hare whistled softly. "Whew. There's a pretty theoretical problem for you. What would happen when the perfect detector set out to catch the perfect criminal? Rather like the immovable object in the irresistible force business, and just about as sensible. The fly in the ointment, of course, is that there is no such thing as perfection." Dr. Trevor sat up rigidly and glared at the speaker. "There is perfection in the detection of crime." "Well, perhaps there is," Hare laughed amiably. "You should know, Trevor. But I think what you really mean is that there is a perfect method for detecting imperfect crimes." The doctor's rigidity had vanished, and now he was smiling with as much geniality as he had ever displayed. "Well, perhaps that is what I do mean. Perhaps it is. But there is a little experiment I should like to try, just the same." "Oh, and that is?" "And that is, or rather would be, the experiment of exercising all my intelligence in the commission of a crime. Then, forgetting every detail of it utterly, using my skill and knowledge to solve the riddle of my own creation. Should I catch myself, or should I escape myself? That's the question." "Well, it would be a nice sporting event," agreed Hare, "but I'm afraid it's one that can't be pulled off. The little trifle of forgetting is the difficulty, but it would be interesting to see the outcome." "Yes, it would," said the other, speaking rather more dreamily than was his habit. "But we can never see quite as far as we should like to. My Japanese man, Tanaka, has a saying that he resorts to whenever he is asked a difficult question. He simply smiles and answers, 'Fuji-san ni nobatara sazo toku made Miyamasho. It means, I believe, that if one were to ascend Mount Fuji, one could see far. The trouble is that, as in the case of so many problems, we can't climb the mountain. Wise Tanaka, but tell me, Trevor, what is your conception of a perfect crime? Well, I'm afraid it isn't precisely formulated, but I have a rough outline in my mind, and I'll give it to you as well as I can. First, though, let's go up to the library. We shall be more comfortable there, and it will give Tanaka a chance to clear the table. Bring your cigar and come along. Together, the two men climbed the narrow staircase, the host leading. Dr. Trevor's house was a compact, brick building in the East 50s, not far from Madison Avenue. Its picturesqueness was rather uncharacteristic of its owner, but its neatness was entirely like him. It was not a large house, according to the standards of wealthy New York, but it was a perfect appointed one, and considerably more spacious than it looked from the street. For the doctor had built on an addition that completely covered the plot, which had once been the backyard. And this new section, as well as housing the kitchen and servants' quarters below, held a laboratory and workroom two stories high. An industrial or research chemist might have coveted the equipment of that room, and the filing cases that completely lined the encircling gallery would have furnished any newspaper with a complete reference department. A door opened from the library into the laboratory, and the library itself came close to being the ideal chamber of every student. Dr. Harrison Trevor's house was, in short, an ideal bachelor establishment, and he had never been tempted to transform it into anything else. More than one male visitor had found reason to remark, "Well, old Trevor does well for himself." The same idea flitted across Hare's mind as he puffed at his host's excellent cigar and tasted the liqueur that Tanaka had placed on the table beside his chair. He, too, enjoyed the pleasures of bachelorhood, but he would make a few improvements in the routine of his life. He could afford them. The perfect crime must, of course, be a murder. Trevor's voice broke the silence that had followed their entrance into the library. Hare shifted his bulk a little and inquired, "Yes? Oh, why?" "Well, because it is, according to our accepted standards, the most reprehensible of all crimes and, therefore, according to my interests, the best. Human life is what we prize most and do our best to protect. To take human life with an art that eludes all detection is unquestionably the ideal criminal action. In it, there is a degree of beauty possible in no other crime." "Huh," grunted Hare. "You make it sound pleasant. Oh, I am speaking at once as an amateur and as a professor crime. You have heard surgeons talk of beautiful cases. Well, that is my attitude precisely, and in my case, invariably. As in most of theirs, the patient dies."
"I see."
Trevor blinked, tugged at his eyeglasses cord, and then continued. "The crime must be murder, and it must be murder of a particular kind, the purest kind. Now, what is the purest kind? Well, let's see. The crime passionnel can be ruled out at once, for it is almost impossible that it should be perfect. Passion does not make for art. Hot blood begets innumerable blunders. What about the murder for gain? Murderers of this kind make murder a means, not an end in itself. They kill, not for the sake of eliminating the victim, but in order to profit by the victim's death. Now, we can't look to murder for profit as a type that might produce our perfect crime. The sharp-nosed doctor paused and held his cigar for a moment between his thin lips. Hare studied his face curiously. The man's complete lack of emotion in discussing such matters was not wholly pleasant, he reflected. Trevor put down his cigar. Now, how about political and religious murders? They can be counted out almost immediately for the simple reason that the murderer in such cases is always convinced that he is either serving the public or serving God, and therefore seldom makes any attempt to conceal his guilt. But there is another class to be considered. Those who kill for the sheer joy of killing. Those who are dominated by the bloodlust. Offhand, you would think that their killing would be of the purest type. But as I have said before, the maniac invariably repeats himself, and his repetition leads to his discovery. And even more important is the consideration that the artist must possess the faculty of choice, and that the born killer has no choice. His actions are not willed by himself, they are compelled, whereas the perfect crime must be a work of art, not of necessity. "Well, you seem to have written off all the possibilities pretty well," remarked Hare. The doctor shook his head quickly. "No, not at all. There is one type of murder left, and it is the kind we are looking for. The murder of elimination, the murder in which the sole and pure object is to remove the victim from the world, to get rid of a person whose continued existence is not desirable to the murderer." "But that brings you back to your crime passionnel, doesn't it? Practically all murders of jealousy, for example, are murders of elimination, aren't they?" "Well, in a sense, yes. But not in the purest sense. And, as I have said before, passion can never produce the perfect crime. It must be studied, carefully meditated, and performed in absolutely cold blood. Otherwise, it is sure to be imperfect. You do go at this in a rather fish-blooded way," remarked the good listener, as the doctor paused for a moment. "Well, of course I do, and that is the only way the perfect crime could be committed. Now, I can imagine a pure murder of elimination that would be ideal so far as motives and circumstances were concerned. Suppose you had spent 15 years establishing a certain reading of a dubious passage in one of Pindar's odes." Interrupted Hare jocosely. "Suppose I had." "And suppose," continued Dr. Harrison Trevor, not noticing the interruption, "that another scholar had managed to build up an argument which completely invalidated your interpretation. Suppose, further, that he communicated his proofs to you and that he had as yet mentioned them to no one else. There you would have a perfect motive and a perfect set of circumstances. Only the method of the murder would remain to be worked out." Gregory Hare sat bolt upright. "Good God, man! What do you mean, the method of the murder?" The doctor blinked. "Why, don't you understand? You would have excellent reasons for eliminating your rival and thereby saving your own interpretation of the text from confutation. And no one, once your victim was dead and the proofs destroyed, could suspect that you had any such motive. You could work with perfect freedom, and you could concentrate on two essentials, the method of the murder and, of course, the disposition of the body." "The disposition of the body?" Hare seemed to echo the speaker's last words involuntarily. "To be sure, that is a very important item, most important, in fact. Well, but I flatter myself," and here the doctor chuckled softly, "that I have done some very valuable research along that line." "You have, eh?" murmured Hare. "And what have you found out?" "Well, I'll tell you later," Trevor assured him. And I don't think I would tell any other man alive, because it really is too simple and too dangerous. But at the moment I want to impress on you that the disposition of the body is perhaps the most important step of all in the commission of the perfect crime. The absence of a corpus delicti is curiously troublesome to the police. Harrington should really have managed to get rid of West's body, although it probably would have kept him from sitting in the electric chair 2 weeks ago. He was too careless. Hare again sat up sharply and exclaimed, "Was he? Speaking of that, it was the Harrington case that I chiefly wanted to talk to you about tonight." "Oh, was it? Well, we can get around to that in a minute. And, by the way, that came pretty close to being a murder of elimination, if you like. But the money element figured in it. Big money, and gold is apt to have a fairly strong smell when it is mixed up with crime." Harrington's motive was easily traced, but his position made it impossible to touch him until we had our case absolutely watertight. "Watertight, eh? That's what I want to hear about. You see, I was abroad until last week, and I didn't even know Harrington had been arrested until just before I sailed. The North African newspapers aren't so informative. I was particularly interested, you see, because I knew both men fairly well, and West's wife even better." "Oh, yes, his wife. Gorgeous woman. They were separated, and she's been in Europe for the last 2.5 years. "Yes, I know she has. Most of the time." "All the time. She hasn't been in the United States during that period." "Oh, hasn't she? Well, I last saw her at Monte Carlo, but that's not important at the moment. I want to hear how you tracked down Harrington." Dr. Harrison Trevor smiled complacently, adjusted his eyeglasses, and then launched forth in his characteristic manner. "It was really simplicity itself. The only flaw was that Harrington finally confessed. That rather annoyed me, for we didn't need a confession. The circumstantial evidence was complete." "Circumstantial? Oh, of course. You know as well as I do that most convictions for murder are based on circumstantial evidence. One doesn't send out invitations for a killing." "Well, no, of course not. Sorry." "Well, as you probably know, Ernest West, Wall Street operator and multimillionaire, as the papers had it, was found shot through the heart one night a little more than a year ago. He had a shack down on Long Island near Smithtown that he used as a base for duck shooting and fishing. The only servant he kept there was an old housekeeper, a local inhabitant. He liked to lead the simple life when he could, never even used to take a chauffeur down with him. The evening he was killed, the housekeeper was absent, spending the night with a sick daughter of hers in Jamaica. She testified that West had sent her off, saying that he could pick up a light supper and breakfast for himself. She turned up the next morning and nearly died of the shock. West was shot in what was kind of a gun room, where he kept all his gear and a few books. Cozy sort of place, and the best room in the house. There was no sign of a struggle. He was sitting slumped in a big armchair. A bullet that killed him was a .25 caliber. First of the Homicide Bureau called me up as soon as the regulars failed to locate any scent, and I went down there immediately. West was an important man, you know." The doctor tugged self-consciously at his black cord. "I went down there at once, and I discovered various things. First of all, the house was isolated, and there was no one in the neighborhood who could give any useful evidence whatsoever. The body had been discovered by a messenger boy with a telegram at about 7:30. Medical examination indicated that the murder had been committed about an hour before. Inside the house, I found only one item that I thought useful. After going over the dust and so forth, which I swept up from the gunroom floor, I had several tiny thread ends that had pretty obviously come from a tweed suit, and those threads could not be matched in West's wardrobe. But they might have been months old, so I didn't concentrate on them at first. Outside the house, there was more to go on. The ground was damp, and two sets of footprints were visible, a man's and a woman's. A woman's hair was all attention now. Yes, the housekeepers, of course. Oh, yes, yes, the housekeepers. Certainly, but it was difficult to identify them for the reason that the man, apparently through nervousness, had walked up and down his lane leading to the road several times before finally leaving the scene of his crime. And he had trampled almost every one of the woman's footprints, scarcely leaving one intact. Well, that was odd, wasn't it? Oh, yes, very, at first glance, but really simple enough when you think it over. The murderer had hurried out of the house after firing the fatal shot. Then he hesitated. He was flurried and couldn't make up his mind as to his next step, even though he had an automobile waiting for him at the end of the lane. So he walked up and down for a few minutes to calm his nerves and collect his ideas. It was a narrow lane, and the obliteration of the other tracks was at once accidental and inevitable. He had a car waiting. Yes, a heavy touring car. Its tire marks were plain, as were those of the public hack that West had ordered for his housekeeper that afternoon. And there was one interesting feature about the marks. There was a big, hard blister on one of the shoes, and it left a perfectly defined indentation in the mud every time it came around. Oh, I see. And both sets of footprints ended at the same spot? Well, naturally. The hack stopped for the woman just where the murderer later parked his car. Hare now had lighted a new cigar, and he puffed at it reflectively before asking. And you are quite sure the woman did not get into the car with the man? Trevor stared at the speaker blankly and exclaimed, "You must be wool gathering." The woman was the housekeeper, and she went off in a public hack at least 2 hours before the crime was committed. In any event, Harrington confirmed the correctness of all my deductions when he finally confessed. Dr. Harrison Trevor was obviously nettled. Oh, yes, of course he did. I'd forgotten. Sorry. Let's hear how you nabbed him. For a moment, the detective looked at his companion, doubtfully, as though he feared the other might be baiting him. For Hare's question had not been of the sort that his alert mind usually asked. He seemed to have something up his sleeve, but Trevor thrust his suspicion aside and returned to the pleasant task of describing his triumph. With the bullet, the footprints, the tire marks, and the threads, I had considerable to go on. All I had to do was to relate them unmistakably to one man, and I had my murderer. But the trail soon led into quarters where we had to move cautiously. With my material evidence in front of me, I set out to fasten upon some individual who might have had a motive for killing West. So far, as anyone could say, he had no enemies, but on the other hand, he had few friends. He believed in the maxim that he travels fastest who travels alone. However, he had nipped some men pretty badly in the street, and it was upon his financial operations that I soon concentrated my attention. There, with the facilities for investigation at my command, I discovered with some very interesting facts. During the 3 weeks prior to West's death, the common stock of Elliott Light and Power had risen 57 points. 4 days after he had been shot, it had dropped back no less than 63 points. Investigation showed that on the day West was murdered, Harrington was short 130-odd thousand shares of that particular stock. He had been selling it short all the way up, and West had been buying all that was offered. Harrington's resources, great as they were, weren't equal to his rival's. He knew that unless he could break Elliott Common wide open, he was a ruined man, and he took the one sure way to do it that he could think of. He eliminated West. It was murder for millions. Trevor paused impressively. Hare did not say a word. That's about all there is to the story. The rest of it was routine sleuthing. One of my men found four tires, three in perfect condition, which had been taken from Harrington's touring car and replaced on the day following the murder. They had been put in a loft of a garage on Harrington's country place. Three perfect tires, mind you, and on the fourth, there was a large, hard blister. Harrington's shoes fitted the footprints in West's lane, and the thread ends matched the threads of one of Harrington's suits. And, to top it all off, after the man was arrested, we found a .25 pearl-handled revolver in his wall safe. One shot had been fired, and the weapon hadn't been cleaned since. Harrington's chauffeur testified that his master had taken out the big touring car alone on the afternoon of the murder. The man remembered the date because it had been his wife's birthday. It was all very simple, and even such elements of interest as it possessed were lessened by Harrington's confession. The press made much too much of the air about my part in the affair. The doctor smiled deprecatingly. It really was no mystery at all, and if the men involved had not been so rich and so prominent, the case would have been virtually ignored. But we nailed him just in time. He was sailing for Europe the following week. "What kind of revolver did you say it was?" Hare asked the question so abruptly that Trevor started before answering.
Why, it was a .25 caliber, pearl-handled, and nickel-finished. Rather a dainty weapon altogether.
Harrington was a bit apologetic about owning such a toy.
Well, I should think he might have been. Was the handle slightly chipped on the right side?
Trevor leaned forward suddenly. Yes, it was. How the devil did you know?
Why, it got chipped when Alice dropped it on the rock at Davos. The four of us were target shooting back at the hotel.
"Alice!" exclaimed Trevor. "What Alice, and what do you mean by the four of you?"
Hare answered quietly. "Alice West, my dear fellow. You see, it was her gun, and the four of us were West, Alice, Harrington, and myself. We were all staying at the same hotel in Switzerland 4 years ago."
"Her gun?" The doctor was speaking excitedly now. "You mean she gave it to him?"
"Oh, no, I doubt it. Much as she loved him," drawled Hare, "he probably took it away from her. Too late."
"You're talking in riddles," snapped the detective. "What do you mean?"
"Well, simply that the little weapon helped to execute the wrong man," said Hare wearily.
"The wrong man?"
"Well, yeah, that's one way of putting it. But in this case, I am very much afraid that the right man was a woman."
Trevor's apparent excitement had vanished abruptly, and now he was as calm as a sphinx.
"Tell me exactly what you mean," he demanded.
Hare put aside the butt of his cigar.
"It all began back in Davos. 4 years ago,
Harrington fell in love with Alice West, and she fell in love with him. West played dog in the manger. He wouldn't let his wife divorce him, and he wouldn't divorce her. They separated, of course, but
that didn't help Allison Harrington toward getting married. I was on the inside of the affair from the first, you see, accidentally to begin with, and afterwards because they all made me their confidant in various degrees. West behaved like a swine because he really didn't love the woman anymore. He simply had made up his mind that no other man was going to have her, legally at least, and he stuck to it until she killed him. She killed him? The great detective spoke softly. I'm as sure of it as though I had seen her do it. To begin with, it was her revolver that fired the shot, as you have proved to me. I've seen it 100 times when we were firing at bottles and whatnot for fun. There was no reason for Harrington to borrow it. He had a nice little armory of his own, hadn't he? Yes, we did find a couple of heavy service revolvers and an automatic. Exactly. He never would have used a toy like that in 1,000 years. And besides, he would never have committed a murder. He was too level-headed. Alice, on the other hand, is an extremely hysterical type. I've seen her go completely off her head with anger. Beautiful? Oh, Lord, yes. But dangerous. And in the last analysis, a coward. She proved that. I never did envy Harrington. But she was in Europe, man, when the murder was committed. She was not, Trevor. She was in Montreal that very month, to my certain knowledge, and Montreal isn't so far from Long Island. Harry Sands ran into her at the Ritz there, and they were reminiscing about it at Monte Carlo the last time I saw her. She was in Europe before and after the murder, but she wasn't there when it happened. Anyway, that's not the whole story. Well, what is it? Trevor's mouth was grim. Hare's fingers were playing with the silver matchbox, and he hesitated a minute before answering. Then he spoke quickly and to the point. The rest of it is this. As I told you, Alice is hysterical, and during the past few years, drink and dope haven't helped her any. Well, one night at Monte, just before I left, she went off the deep end, and we had been talking about her husband's death, and I had been speculating as to who could have done it. Harrington hadn't been arrested then, and I'd been asking her, too, if she and Harrington weren't going to get married soon. She dodged that question, obviously embarrassed. Then suddenly she burst out into a wild tirade against the dead man, calling him every name under heaven, and finally dived into her evening bag and fished out a letter. It was addressed to her, and the postmark was more than a year old. It was almost broken at the creases from having been read over and over again. She shoved it at me and insisted that I read it. It was from West, and it was a cruel letter, if I've ever read one. It was the letter of a cat to a mouse, a jailer to his prisoner. West had her where he wanted her, and he intended to keep her there. He didn't miss a trick when it came to rubbing it in. It was so bad that I didn't want to finish it, but she made me. When I gave it back to her, her eyes were blazing, and she grabbed my hand and cried, "What would you do to a man like that?" I hemmed and hawed for a minute, and she answered herself by exclaiming, "Kill him, kill him, wouldn't you?" As calmly as I could, I pointed out that someone had already done just that, and she burst into a fit of the wickedest laughter I've ever heard. Then she calmed down, powdered her nose, and said quietly, "You know, it's funny that you can shoot the heads off of all the innocent bottles you like, and no one says a word, but if you kill a human snake, they hang you for it. And I don't want to hang, thank you very much." Hare paused, as though he were very tired, and then he added, "That's about all there was to it. It wasn't very nice. I left for Africa the next day, and I scarcely ever saw the papers there. but I hadn't any doubts as to who had bumped off Ernest West. While the minute hand on the mantel clock jumped 3 minutes, there was silence in the book-lined room. Then Trevor spoke, and his voice was strained.
"So, you think I made a mistake?"
Hare looked him straight in the eye.
"What do you think?"
The detective took refuge in another question. "Have you any theory as to what really happened?"
"It's hard to say exactly, but I'm sure she did it.
Her reference to the bottle showed that she knew what weapon had been used. She must have done in 1,000 bottles with it at various times. My guess is that she and Harrington went down to see West together, to see if they couldn't make him change his mind after all, and that they had failed. Then she pulled out that little toy of hers. She always carried it around in her bag. I used to tell her that it was a bad habit. She shot West before he could move. She was a better shot than Harrington. He could never have found the man's heart. Then they left the house and drove off in Harrington's car. But first of all, he went back and thoroughly trampled out every one of her footprints, and, just to make sure he wasn't missing any, he walked over the housekeeper's as well. There were 3 sets of tracks there, Trevor, not 2. I'll bet on that. Then Harrington took the gun away from her, if he hadn't taken it before, and drove her to wherever she wanted to go. She left him to stand the gaff if he was suspected, and it was like him to do what he did. He loved her, if any man ever loved a woman, and she loved him in her own way, but it wasn't the best way in the world. She loved her own white neck considerably more.
Hare smiled a wry smile.
She had forgotten that New York State doesn't go in for hanging, although it is not a pretty tale. But Harrington, poor devil, wanted to save the woman, even if she wasn't worth it. You see?
To him she was.
"It's impossible!" Trevor snapped out the words as if despite himself.
"Oh, what is?"
"That I made a mistake."
"We all make mistakes, my dear fellow."
"I don't."
The tight mouth was tighter than ever.
"Well, it's a shame, but what's done is done." Hare shrugged his shoulders.
Trevor looked at him with cold eyes. "Obviously you do not understand. My reputation does not permit of mistakes. I simply can't make them. That's all."
Hare mustered a genial smile. He was genuinely sorry that Trevor was so distressed, and he sought to reassure him.
"Oh, but your reputation isn't going to suffer. The facts won't come out. Alice West will be dead of dope inside of 2 years, if I'm any judge, and no one else knows."
"You do."
"Well, yes, I do, but we can forget about that."
Trevor nodded nervously. Yes, we must. Do you understand, Hare? We must."
Hare studied him quizzically.
"Ah, don't worry, old chap. Your reputation's safe with me. I'll keep my mouth shut."
Trevor nodded again, more nervously and more emphatically.
Yes, I know you will, of course. I know you will."
"And how about a drink?" Hare swung himself out of his chair.
On the table, there. Help yourself. I'm going to go to the laboratory for a minute."
The doctor disappeared down through a low door, and Hare busied himself with the decanters and the bottles in a preoccupied manner. He was sorry that Trevor was so upset, but what colossal egotism! Perhaps he should have held his tongue. Nothing had been gained. He would never mention the subject again. It was a stiff drink of brandy that Hare finally poured himself, and he held it up to the light, studying it with his back to the laboratory door. But he never drank it, for he dropped the glass
as he felt the lean fingers at his throat and the chloroform pad smothering his mouth and nostrils. He managed only to say the two words, "My God!" About 15 minutes later, Dr. Harrison Trevor peered cautiously over the banister of his own stairway. There was no one below, and he descended swiftly. In the kitchen, Tanaka heard the front door slam, and almost immediately afterwards his master's voice calling him from the first floor landing. Tanaka responded briskly. "Mr. Hare has just left," said the doctor, "and he forgot his cigarette case. Run after him. He may still be in sight." Tanaka sped on his errand. Yes, there on the corner was a tall man, obviously Hare-san, but he was getting into a taxi. Tanaka ran, but before he was halfway down the block, Hare-san had driven off. Tanaka returned to report failure. "Oh, too bad," said his master, who met him on the landing. "But it doesn't really matter. Telephone Mr. Hare's apartment and tell his man that Mr. Hare left his case here, and that he's not to worry about it. You can take it to him in the morning." Tanaka went downstairs to obey orders, and his master was left to wonder at the coincidence of the man who looked like Hare getting into the taxi. The accidental evidence might prove useful, but it was quite unnecessary, quite unnecessary. He had no need of accidental aid. At the door of his library, the detective paused and surveyed the scene with a critical eye. Everything was in place, comfortably, conventionally, indisputably in place. There were no fragments of the broken tumbler on the floor, only a dark, wet spot on the carpet that was drying rapidly. Branding and soda would leave no stain. Dr. Harrison Trevor smiled a chilly smile and then walked resolutely toward the laboratory where his task awaited him. Once the door had been locked behind him, his first act was to switch on the electric ventilator fan, which carried off all the obnoxious odors through a concealed flue. After that, he worked into the morning hours. The disappearance of Mr. Gregory Hare, eminent criminal lawyer, within a week after his return from abroad, finished the front pages of the newspapers with rather more than a 9 days' wonder. It was Dr. Trevor who was the first to insist upon foul play, and it was Dr. Trevor who worked fervently upon the case, with all the assistance that the police could give him. Naturally, he was deeply concerned, for Hare had been an intimate acquaintance, and he had been among the last to see the man alive. But the body was never found, and there was no evidence to go on. Tanaka repeated what he knew, reiterating the story of the taxi, and a patrolman on fixed post confirmed the Japanese testimony. The tall gentleman had come from the direction of Dr. Trevor's house and had driven off just as the servant had come running after him. All of which helped, not at all. A certain limping Louis, whom Hare, years before when he was district attorney, had sent up for a long term, was dragged in by police net, but he had a perfect alibi. The mystery remained a mystery. Dr. Trevor and Inspector First were discussing the case one afternoon, long after it had been abandoned. First still toyed with the idea that it might not have been murder, but the doctor was positive. "Oh no, I'm absolutely sure of it, First. Absolutely sure. Hare was killed." "Well," said the inspector, "if you are so sure, I'm inclined to agree. You've never made a mistake."
Okay, I'm moving over to the Playboy Book of Crime and Suspense, a story by Ray Russell, and it's called Last Will and Testament. Events having taken an unexpected and intolerable turn, I, the undersigned, sound of mind and body, having this day resolved to die by my own hand, do acknowledge the following articles as my final words and solemn legacy. To my lovely and loving wife, were she alive, I should have left that which is now without value to me, my worldly goods. Esteeming as she did material things above all else, she would have been welcome to all of my estates and possessions. I do not expect to meet her spirit in the other world. She was so much of the flesh that I am certain she ceased to be the moment I killed her. To my advisers, I leave the guidance and comfort of their own advice. To the shades of my mother, my half-brother, and my first wife, I send my greetings before me and my heartfelt apologies for having murdered their fleshly counterparts. Also, these messages. To my first wife, oh, my dear, I look forward to your company. In this life, I never appreciated you. Your gentle wit, your graciousness, your nobility and charm of person were wasted upon me. In the fever of my youth, I preferred the hot limbs of your successor to the cool wisdom of your conversation. Forgive me, my dear. My erring flesh I leave behind me. Welcome my flawless spirit, I entreat you. Brother, I know you were angry with me after I fed you that poison. I felt your spirit haunting me for months. Gradually you stopped, so I assume that you have forgiven me and have reflected that, after all, one of us had to go. If you had thought of it first, I would have been the haunting spirit. See how time brings equality to everything. Soon I, too, will be a spirit, and there will be no jealousy between us. I look forward to meeting you again. Ah, mother. Between us there need be no apologies. In this life you became an obstruction. In the realm of the spirit you will be a constant joy. Let me assure you that I have never felt shame about our intimacy, that the criticism leveled at us by moralists has neither brought a blush to my face nor regret to my heart. Man is born out of a woman. What could be more fitting, more poetic, than that she should introduce him to the mysteries of Aphrodite? I have always considered King Oedipus an exciting but silly play. It is well known that I am gifted with a poetic turn of mind. Perhaps, then, I may be forgiven for lapsing into verse for a brief space here. It is not, perhaps, my best, but be charitable, it is my last. To the common man I leave these lines. I stand apart from the ugly folk. The ugly folk with unbeautiful voices choke the streets and arbors that I love, obstructing beauty, filtering it through literal minds and tiny souls and unenthusiastic appetites. I stand apart. I may not be a lovely thing to hear nor yet to see. My soul is maybe puny, and my mind is often narrower than humankind. My lusts offhand sometimes, and lacking heart, no matter. I am I stand apart. To my venerable tutors, both living and dead, to all philosophers and logicans in general, I leave this little jingle. A traitor serpent sleeps below, who rises at a glance, a play of light upon a curve, a sway of flesh, deliberate and slow. Come off it, then, cast off your load of logic, for it's all a whim that can be swept away by him each time he hankers to explode. Okay, enough of that. My muse is satisfied. To posterity,
to the bloodhounds and scavengers of history, to that breed of men who presume to judge other men, to the shaking heads and the clicking tongues and the hands thrown high in horror, I send greetings and some wisdom garnered during a relatively short but immeasurably full life. Turn your eyes inward. Examine mercilessly your weaknesses, your prejudices, your passions. Peer deep, deep down into the dark and airless labyrinth of unvoiced, unsated, sometimes unheard of, almost unthought of desires. Bring out each black lust and vengeful feeling. Root out all selfish thoughts. Line them up and scrutinize them in the clear, unwavering light of total honesty. Reflect how opportunity combined with authority might have made acts out of those hideous caprices cowering there in the light. And then only, in the words of that renegade Jew of Nazareth, he that is without sin among you, let him cast a stone. Oh, these articles I do earnestly pledge to be my legacy, to which I affix my signature below, calling as witness the spirit of my foster father, Claudius, now enthroned among the gods in timeless glory, Nero, Emperor of Rome. Yeah, I bet that didn't work out as well for him as he thought it might have. That's it for this episode of the Mystery Hour. Folks, I'm Keith Tyler saying thanks again for tuning in. Join me again next time, would you please? Make sure your I love yous are in order. Thanks. So long.